This is Dori Smith for Regime Change Radio, a half-hour program on the importance of voting to bring about regime change in America. On February 14th and March 20th, 2003, millions of people took to the streets to try to stop the U.S. from invading and occupying Iraq. Now, a year later, peace activists are preparing to take to the streets again on those days to protest U.S. foreign policy of preemptive war. The website of internationalanswer.org calls for a global day of action on the first anniversary of the U.S. bombing and invasion of Iraq, March 20th. Major demonstrations are planned on that day in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and many other cities, as people from around the world join their voices in a call to end the occupation and bring the troops home. The International Network to End the War Against Iraq has called for global vigils for peace to be held at dusk on Sunday, February 15th. Today, Mike Smolik of that group joins us to talk about the vigil. As you listen to this discussion, you can log on to endthewar.org to study the website, or if you're not able to go online, you can call End the War toll-free at 1-888-363-2927. That's 1-888-END-A-WAR. Mike Smolik is a foreign policy expert who began doing peace and justice work in order to end the sanctions against Iraq. Former UN Assistant Secretary General Dennis Halliday resigned after 34 years of service at the UN in protest of the sanctions imposed on Iraq in 1990. Halliday said, quote, "We are in the process of destroying an entire society. It is as simple and terrifying as that." Mike, welcome to Regime Change Radio.
Thank you, Dori.
It's great to be talking with you again, and especially since right now you have a program underway to build up the numbers of people who are sending their message to the Bush administration and the world that they want peace. And you're doing that with a vigil. Tell us a little bit about what you have planned for February 15th.
Well, it's just an open call. We want people to go out and reach out to the local communities, basically, on February 15th. And hold a local peace vigil with candlelight and shape the message in whatever way they see fit. We, of course, are a network focused on the situation in Iraq and are calling for peace in Iraq. But we're also, asking people to reach out to the community on all levels to build strength at the community level of their organizations that are working for peace and connections between them. It's also a great opportunity for people who are preparing for the March 20th demonstrations that are being organized by other coalitions to, do some outreach and build numbers for that event as well. So we felt that because we're a network of grassroots organizations, that this would be a great opportunity. We didn't know of anybody else who was making use of the February 15th date, so we thought it would be a great opportunity to commemorate what happened last year on February 15th with millions of people around the world in over 600 cities, actually, and the largest protest in known history, to kind of commemorate that and do so with a peace vigil.
It is important to remember, isn't it, that so many millions demonstrated against this war last year. So what you're saying is that whether you're five people or 500, whether you are locally involved or not locally involved, you can at least get out on that day, February 15th, with your candle to show that you want a peace initiative.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we want people to reach out to all of their international contacts, because we do want to make this a global vigil. And we do feel like it's a date that people around the world remember. And I think momentum is going to build as we get closer to that date because people are just going to scratch their heads and say, wait a minute, what's going on February 15th? I mean, we had that huge thing last year. So I'm really hoping that this will take off. And we are reaching out to, other coalitions to try and get their support and help publicize the event.
And so really community centers and school campuses, churches, civic organizations, you can all get together your own groups on your own street corners. You can get together your own street and block, and it can really take off and send a message to the White House that we want a peace initiative. You know, Mike, it seems such a short time, and yet So much has happened since last February. But I can recall what you were writing about and thinking about at that time. And ironically, in February a year ago, you were talking about Colin Powell going to address the United Nations to talk about whether or not the U.S. should invade Iraq. This was February 5th when this discussion was underway, and you were writing about the fact that Powell, this is the Secretary of State, of course, did not have any plan in his pocket that had anything to do with anything other than an invasion. Now we see the U.N. again in the news. We have the U.S. administrator in Baghdad, Paul Bremer, and George Bush going to talk to the U.N. about various countries, contracts, and Iraq again.
Well, I think one thing obviously hasn't changed, and that is that the U.S. is the world's sole superpower. And as the world's sole superpower, they're able to essentially call the shots at the United Nations. And, it kind of cuts both ways. I mean, Bush said the U.N. would become irrelevant if they didn't sort of get behind his invasion. And in some ways, I think that's unfortunately true. That the UN has kind of, become marginalized by the facts. On the other hand, the UN is still sort of the one body that has the legitimacy and the authority to, to place limitations or to make conditions on what the United States can and can't do in Iraq. Not that those are really in place right now, but I think that's part of negotiating. And so there is a kind of a negotiating chip, if you will, that the UN has to play. It's, namely the rest of the world's sort of input on this whole scenario. But it's been really disheartening to see the way in which the UN has kind of rolled over, particularly recently. And in some sense, you can say it would make sense if you were a UN bureaucrat to do this, but the turning over the whole Oil for Food program to the U.S. Coalition authority. It was always a controversial program. In my view, the sanctions run through the UN were a genocidal program that led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. The Oil for Food program was intended to stem the destruction of that, or limit it, the amount of destruction that sanctions did. But it became something which actually ended up propping up the regime of Saddam Hussein, because it gave the regime a greater control over people's breadbaskets. And so then after the invasion, obviously it was very sort of murky as to what's supposed to happen with this program, and it was kept in place because so many Iraqis were still depending on that food basket. Well, now that's been turned over to the Americans, so the UN has washed its hands. It kind of reminds you of Congress and its resolution to just sort of wash its hands of the whole issue and hand it all over to the Bush administration and say, you guys can go to war if you want to. And it's very dangerous because, you now have the United States government in a position of unprecedented authority in world affairs, really, and the United Nations not necessarily giving its blessing, but, not condemning what really ought to be condemned, which is the inability of the Americans to live up to the obvious mandate of any occupying power, and that is the first thing on the agenda is to protect the civilian population.
A lot has changed since February of last year, and countries that we were once discussing sanctions against Iraq with, we're now discussing much larger global security issues. The stakes have gotten higher as far as international terrorism goes. Iraq has turned out to be a very difficult place to secure. And so countries that are discussing whether or not they will send troops and whether or not they will even take up contracts to do reconstruction work and or oil industry work in Iraq are looking at a whole different situation now than they were. How much do you think that will impact the discussion at the United Nations?
Well, I'm not sure how much has actually changed. I mean, since September 11th, 2001, the world was sort of put on notice that the United States, was going to launch this war on terrorism and was going to be hunting people around the world and was looking for participants. And, of course, Bush made the statement, you're either with us or you're against us. And the Bush administration has gone ahead with this invasion despite the enormous protests and despite the tremendous reluctance of governments who are normally aligned with the U.S. So I think there's definitely a feeling at the United Nations and among key players like France and Germany that, they continue to be reluctant to sort of cede so much power to the United States. But they're also reluctant to step forward and openly condemn violations of international law, the use of depleted uranium and such illegal weapons, cluster bombs, and so on. You know, all of the most egregious aspects of this war, the world community has been pretty mute on that, because, of course, they are, as you alluded to, looking to get oil contracts, looking to get in on the action as far as the privatization of Iraq's economy, but mainly because the U.S. is kind of the global enforcer, as Noam Chomsky often uses the term, and, they can be disciplined, they can be punished for, fully breaking ranks. So I think what you have is a situation where there's quiet reluctance, but in some sense, I think the U.S. has managed to keep these countries where it wants them, in terms of the Bush administration's agenda.
So that the United Nations has not exactly announced that the war was unnecessary. What they have done is to complain about the consequences and criticize the policy in some ways, and that would be Kofi Annan has said some fairly strong things, but has not condemned the war as such and has not continually, at least, criticized the president's statements about the war.
Well, I think one thing that's worth mentioning is the Nixon doctrine that, again, Noam Chomsky often alludes to, which is that if you act in a sort of wild and crazy and aggressive manner, people will sort of back off and won't know what to do with you. And I think that sort of applies here. It is pretty unclear what other nations could do, especially if say Russia were to take strong position. Would that actually put Russia on some kind of military, on a course towards some kind of military conflict with the U.S. I mean, that's a serious possibility, and I mean, if Russia were to take such a position, but clearly that's one thing that holds people in check, and if the United States is demonstrating that it's willing to invade countries without any real provocation and without United Nations authority, it really does, as I think I said in another interview recently, the U.S. and Israel in the Middle East could not really take a much more aggressive posture.
Well, the Interhemispheric Resource Center has produced a new webpage, and it's rightweb.irc. That's right, R-I-G-H-T, web.irc, talking about the right and talking specifically recently about the book of Richard Perle, The War on Evil. And what Perle is after is a modification of the United Nations Charter so that it accommodates the doctrine of preemption. What do you think about something like that?
Well, what Perle's obviously after is an enshrining of the New World Order, it reflected in the UN's charter documents itself, so that the United States is sort of like the emperor and everybody else is a vassal. The argument used by the right that preemption is valid because of the possibility of attacks by terrorists using large weapons does certainly raise some very difficult issues, but it's sort of this projection of that the terrorist groups are coming out of nowhere and they're reacting to nothing, and Perle actually says that this is just radical Islam, which is a danger to the world that we have to go after and root out as an evil, and he does call it an evil as the sort of one thing that justifies all of this, but naturally for Perle the United States and its foreign policy are blameless.
Well, back when we were looking at this initially before, let's say, the end of the 90s, when we were talking about what it would mean for the United States to somehow legitimize policy that would include an invasion and occupation of Iraq, there was a lot more resistance from people at UN that talked about it in the sense of what it would do internationally to the ability to negotiate policy between governments like Russia and America, like Germany, France, England. What kind of damage has been done? In other words, can we as listeners now look to the UN to be a voice of reason in preventing world wars and conflicts like the one that we've created in Iraq, or not?
That's a good question. I think, there's two sort of angles to take on that. On the one hand, you look at the UN's charter documents, and they're really wonderful. they're really coming out of the Second World War and the Holocaust, and they were written by people who are idealistic and who are very serious about creating an organization capable of preventing war and preventing the horrors of war, preventing genocide, and going even further than that with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and so forth. On the other hand, I think what Pearl's proposing is that, you know, the documents should be in line with reality, and the reality is that the United States, being the sole superpower, spending more money on its military than all other countries in the world combined, is you know, this great ogre that nobody can seriously contend with on the battlefield. And so, you know, for Pearl, might makes right, and that should be enshrined as a kind of document, as a kind of policy at the UN. And so going back to what I was saying earlier about the UN sort of, in a sense, becoming irrelevant is, you know, until we figure out how we can create a world in which might makes right is not the policy that governs the day, then, you know, it is going to be very difficult to realize any of the very hopeful and wonderful vision that's laid out in some of the UN's charter documents.
We're talking with Mike Zmolik. He is the outreach coordinator for the National Network to End the War Against Iraq. He is a former professor of international studies at the University of Dubuque. Americans were told that there was an $87 billion allocation, but it looks like there's going to be a lot more in the pipeline of U.S. tax dollars going in than $87 billion. And even as the White House announces this, they're off to the moon and Mars. I mean, I think people are just disoriented now about the number of dollars we're actually talking about. Talk a little bit about that, Mike Zmolik.
Well, you remember that Bush came in and started doing tax cuts right away. And I think with any political regime, you have to look at who the backers are. And, you know, not only are the big oil, timber, natural gas, coal, you know, the big energy companies, the big mining companies behind the Bush administration. But also, during his campaign, he made a lot of overtures to the military and promised that he would be getting a lot of money to the military. And, you know, when he says that, I think what he has in mind are military contractors, first of all. We know that the VA has had some cuts that, you know, resulted in less health care for the troops who are coming back wounded. But at the same time, more and more and bigger contracts. And if anybody can remember, it was sometime last year, I think back in March or April last year, that the Bush administration announced that it wanted to up the military budget to, first of all, over $500 billion a year from $350 billion a year, on up towards $1 trillion over the course of 10 years. So it's very clear that this administration wants to see the military industrial complex thrive, and thrive in a big, big way. And so the question is sort of obvious, and nobody's asking it, but it sort of poses itself, you know, do these people profit from war, and do they want wars to increase their profits? I'll leave it as an open question as to what I think, but, you know, I'm posing the question because it's one that nobody seems to be asking, or not enough people are asking. Now, I should say that on February 24th, there is a call by a number of coalitions for demonstrations at local corporations that do profit from war, you know, your Halliburtons and Bechtels and Lockheed Martins, for people who live in areas where these folks have offices. Our network and other coalitions are calling for local protests to point out that, you know, these companies are profiting from war, and it's a war that we oppose, and troops are dying while they're raking in the dollars.
End the War is putting out a call for global vigils for peace to be held everywhere at dusk, Sunday, February 15th, 2004. Many cities have already signed up, and more are signing up every day. As you will see when you're on the website endthewar.org, organizations and individuals who promote or believe in peace and justice and an end to war are all encouraged to participate and sign up. Now, Mike, as you make these calls for action, you do so as the outreach coordinator for the National Network to End the War Against Iraq. Your organization has a long history of working against the sanctions in Iraq. Is this a time for Americans to be hopeful? Is this a time for Americans to be channeling their angers?
Hopefulness. It's, you know, it's hard in the wake of the sanctions decade to talk about in a way, because I feel like the sanctions were an issue that one of the things the Bush administration did was launched a war because they had backed themselves into a corner on the sanctions issue. The Clinton administration was already in a corner on the sanctions issue. And the way out for some was to just go ahead and try to topple Saddam Hussein, who the Republicans, to the last man, said, you know, is to blame for the sanctions. If the sanctions are killing people, it's all Saddam Hussein's fault. So sanctions just sort of dropped off the radar screen as soon as the declaration of war was made. And that was really what our organization was built around, was addressing the issue of sanctions, as well as some of the other egregious aspects of the first Gulf War, which was, you know, depleted uranium. That's another thing which looms very large, is that we're hearing that where 370 tons of depleted uranium were used in the first Gulf War, up to 2,000 tons were used in this most recent war. And that's another issue which is just not on the radar screen. Nobody's talking about it. There doesn't seem to be any major campaigns about it in the United States right now. So in terms of hopefulness, I mean, I think one high point was February 15th last year. It was just an enormous kind of cathartic event that so many people around the world expressed their views, despite the fact that there were governments that were, you know, towing the line. There were governments who were, who have kind of a history of maligning demonstrations and maligning the so-called left viewpoint. So, you know, to see that, you know, we as a movement in the world for peace are really very strong, and that people are willing on the right day and for the right reason to come out and demonstrate for peace was very encouraging. But I look ahead to the years ahead, and, you know, I feel like we have so much work to do, and I feel like the war has really taken a toll because so many people have felt it so personally that this was a major defeat for the movement for peace. And because we have an administration that is so intimidating and is so willing to use violence and force, and I was alluding earlier to, you know, if the United Nations doesn't know what to do about it, it's hard for ordinary people to know exactly how we're going to convince or limit the ability of people like the Bush administration to use force to achieve their objectives. So, I mean, I look ahead with the sense that there's a tremendous amount of work to be done. On the other hand, that the potential for renewing the movement and rebuilding it anew is out there, given what we've seen with the protests over the past year.
Well, I've heard it said before that nothing really beats the simplest form of protest that the Latin Americans have shown us, which is taken to the streets, and that your group is planning to coordinate a huge turnout on a global basis of people with candles to let it be known that what is wanted is a discussion about a peace initiative, not an initiative that says we can now invade any country we want to for whatever reasons we say are legitimate.
Mm-hmm. I did mention it earlier that we're leaving the theme open, but we wanted an event that was easy for people to participate, so we can broaden the participation, where people who are kind of not sure what's going on, that if we keep the message simple that we're for peace, that they'll feel comfortable enough to come out for that. Because I do think a lot of people are very sort of confused and not sure how to approach the situation in Iraq. And one of the trump cards, of course, that is used as, you know, if you're for peace or if you're for, you know, ending the occupation or what have you, that you're somehow not supporting the troops. And some have tried to turn that around and say, well, supporting the troops means bringing them home, taking them out of harm's way. But I do think that in the public at large, there's a lot of confusion about, you know, people's first instinct is, you know, my brother or my cousin is over there. A lot of them are dying. I don't want them to die. What do I do? But they may not agree with some of the messages that are coming out about, you know, just ending the occupation. I think there's a sense that of being offended if you would suggest that the whole mission, that there was a problem with the mission in the first place. I don't feel like such people are looking at it very critically and taking it apart as we are. And but that's the idea of February 15th is to just get as many people together as we can and make a statement for peace on that day.
Now, Mike Smolik, you've been monitoring this war and the death of Iraqis for a very long time, and it gets overwhelming at a certain point. I mean, we see the news, and there are horrific pictures available on the Internet of just what has happened to the thousands of Iraqis that have been wounded and harmed and are continuing to be wounded and harmed in Iraq. But at this particular point in history, I think we do have more than we will later, let's say, an opportunity that if we do come out in droves and make a huge statement in large numbers about wanting peace and about keeping that statement consistent, this is what we want, you're not talking about it, you have to start or we're not going to elect you to office again. What do you think of that message?
Well, it's a good message. And I mean, part of the debate in with the Democrats is, are the candidates for peace or not? And it's kind of hard to tell. I think with Dennis Kucinich, it's not too hard to tell. I think with Howard Dean, I've heard him say different things. And with Wesley Clark, being somebody who led a war in Kosovo, I have a deep reluctance about some of his statements that he's, wants to promote world peace and so forth. But I think your comment goes back more towards, what is democracy and how is democracy to be approached? I remember in 1988, I was a delegate to the Iowa caucus for Jesse Jackson, and I was sitting in a room full of Jackson supporters who were kind of down because they knew that at that point he wasn't likely to get a lot of votes out of Iowa. And somebody kept saying, well, what would Jesse want? What would Jesse want? And I felt so frustrated because, to me, what democracy is about is us telling our leaders what we want. That's how democracy ought to work. It needs to come from the grassroots. And people need to recognize their power, that they have the ability to do things. And that's, why we sort of keep doing the kind of things that we do to encourage people at the grassroots, at the community level, to build local groups, to come out and make a statement for what they really believe in, instead of all of this compromising, I might vote for so-and-so because he's not as evil as so-and-so. That's kind of the idea of a grassroots peace network, which is our new name. At our last conference in May, the National Network to End the War Against Iraq has been our name since 2001, and at that point people were getting really nervous about the possibility of the Bush administration going on to attack Syria or Iran, and with a name that specifically focused on Iraq, we would be ill-prepared to deal with the eventuality of further invasions. And so we did have a vote for a name. It was very close, but the name that we ended up choosing for our new name was Grassroots Peace Network. However, we've retained the old name because the war is ongoing in Iraq. So starting this year, we're going to start using Grassroots Peace Network and using National Network to End the War Against Iraq as a subtitle, and sort of slowly phase in the new name. But we also, see our organization as fairly unique, that we're sort of a national organization, but one that was brought into being and orchestrated by local community-based groups themselves, and that is all about just supporting the work of those local groups and giving them, empowerment within their own organization and ability to make decisions. That's kind of the whole idea.
Mike Smolik, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Dory.
Mike Smolik can be contacted on his website at the National Network to End the War Against Iraq and the National Grassroots Peace Network at endthewar.org. For further information on this program, write to me, Dory Smith, at Regime Change Radio. That's RCR Radio at AOL.com. Regime Change Radio is produced in the studios of listener-supported WHUS Stores, Radio for the People. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of this station, its management, or the University of Connecticut.